The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Hey everybody, we're going to go ahead and get started. Feel free to keep getting your lunches and have a seat. Is it not on?
Oops, I'm sorry.
My name is Angie McCarthy, and I'm the coordinator for the Women in Law program here at WCL. And on behalf of our program and our co-sponsors, the AU Law Students for Reproductive Justice, I just want to thank you all for coming on this beautiful day for February. Before we get to our wonderful speakers, and we have two more on their way that are on the show, I just want to quickly thank two people without whom today wouldn't have happened. And that is, one is Gerald Hayes, who's an LLM student and gender specialist, and who's also a Women in Law Program Dean's Fellow, and Melissa DeBeer and her staff at the Office of Special Events and Continuing Legal Education. Today's event is part of our Law School's annual Founders Programming, and the celebration honors our two founding mothers, Ellen Spencer Muthey and Emma Gillette, who founded Washington College of Law to ensure that women, as well as men, had a chance to study law. Here at the Women in Law program, we're proud to carry on that legacy, and in part, we do that by pulling together panels every semester on various issues of gender and law. And to bring to light and examine some of the critical issues that are facing women and LGBT communities. We chose this topic today because we wanted to bring to attention and bring our focus back to a more expansive notion of reproductive rights, one that goes beyond just the legal framework that we learn in our classes and to more of a social justice framework. We also wanted to create a space to explore the potential for collaboration between the environmental justice and reproductive justice movements on some of the issues that are common to both of them, in particular the right to have and parent our children in safe and healthy environments. So with that, I will turn our program over to our Associate Director, Danielle Craig. Thanks.
Hi, everyone. This program wouldn't have happened at all without the very, very hard work of Angie and Gerald, who conceived of it from the very beginning and have been working really hard on it. So, and both of them are current students. So, again, it's a reminder to all of you that the Women in the Law program is always really eager to work with students on any issues that you all are interested in. I have a quick question before we begin. How many of you have class at 1:30? Okay. You have to go to class. And I know a lot of you are actually in feminist theory, and you all can continue the conversation on over there. But we're going to go ahead and let our speakers begin. Go ahead and let our speakers begin and just lay out the groundwork for the program. I'm going to give a very, very quick introduction since we're a little bit short on time. But I wanted to emphasize that whenever the Women in the Law program sort of starts in a new area of law, rather than assuming that we are the experts because we are here in, you know, our ivory tower up here on the sixth floor and we are scholars, rather than pretend that we are experts, the first thing that we always do when exploring a new area of law, as Gerald and Angie decided to do, is we look to the people who are working on the ground. In particular, we look to people who are working with activists, who are working with real women and real men to address the environmental or the reproductive or the gender-based issues that they see in their lives. And we always try to ground all of our work in the lived reality of the people who we are trying to serve. And that's a big part of our focus and hopefully will be reflected in the amazing work being done by all of our panelists today. I'm going to introduce all of them at once, and then we'll just go ahead and allow them to speak in order, and we will take questions at the end. Our first speaker is going to be Jill Morrison. She's currently Senior Counsel in Health and Reproductive Rights at the National Women's Law Center, and that's the kind of job that I know a lot of you aspire to hold someday. So you all can buttonhole her afterwards and ask her how she got there. Her focus has largely been on religious restrictions on reproductive health services. She has a very impressive bio and CV for the sake of time today. I'm going to refer you to the CLE materials, but suffice it to say, she knows about getting judicial clerkships and she knows about teaching, and she knows about lots and lots of really interesting things, so please feel free to ask her, I hope, at the end of the session. Our next speaker is going to be Kimberly Inez McGuire, who is a policy analyst at the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. She conducts legislative analysis and evaluates public policy on matters related to the primary program area. So for those of you particularly interested in public policy analysis work, she's a great person to ask about that. Michelle Roberts is the campaign and policy coordinator at Advocates for Environmental Human Rights. And in particular, she works on issues regarding technical assistance and advocacy support to communities regarding impacts of toxins on human health and the environment. And so this is a great example of someone who works directly with communities, helping communities translate their needs into the language that the public policy folks need to use in order to get legislation and policies changed. And finally, Vernice Miller-Travis is the vice chair of the Maryland State Commission on Environmental Justice and Sustainable Communities and the co-founder of the West Harlem Environmental Action. She is also the president of Miller-Travis and Associates and a member of the National Environmental Justice Advisory Council to the US EPA and a co-founder of We Act for Environmental Justice in New York City. Again, somebody who has actually managed to work both at the grassroots level as well as at the highest levels of public policy. And so hopefully all of our speakers today will be able to tell us a little bit about not only the substance of what they do, but how they got to where they are and what they do. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to our first speaker, Jill Morrison.
Thank you.
Absolutely.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me here. Thank you for the great lunch. Set the bar pretty high. I'm going to set that as one of my requirements for speakers. I'll show up, but there have to be burritos. So I have the pleasure of laying the groundwork for today's discussion, and I will be discussing both environmental justice and reproductive justice, but I only have an expertise in one of these areas. But you will learn, if those of you who are lawyers already know, but those of you who are becoming lawyers will learn that not having an expertise in something doesn't stop you from speaking about it ad nauseum. We opine on things we know very little about, and that's kind of our job description. So I've been delighted to learn more about environmental justice over the last few years, largely through a collaboration with Kim, one of my co-panelists. So several years ago, I was working with Law Students for Reproductive Justice. Does anyone know them? Shut up for Alex Oja. And we were trying to help build up their membership. And one of the problems we identified was that students come to law school, progressive students anyway, tend to come to law school and they have their thing, right? This is what I do. I'm all about racial justice. I'm all about environmental justice. I'm all about LGBT. And once students have their thing, it's really hard to get them interested in anything else. So the time and attention that they give to their thing pretty much takes up all of their time and attention. So we decided that we were going to try to help law students figure out how reproductive justice relates to their thing. That way we could get them onto our thing. So hence we birthed a webinar series. So the webinar that we developed both on this topic and other topics, including domestic violence and reproductive justice, education and reproductive justice, racial discrimination and reproductive justice, LGBT and reproductive justice, all of those fact sheets are on both LSRJ's website and the National Women's Law Center's website, and I encourage you to check them out if you're interested. So I collaborated with Kim to do a webinar on environmental justice and reproductive justice. And I took on the task of identifying the commonalities between our two movements. So specifically, I wanted to explore why environmental justice advocates should care about reproductive justice. And I discovered that there is plenty of fertile ground for cooperation and collaboration between the two movements. I wish I had come up with the fertile ground thing. I missed it. Duh. So to start out, I will set some basic definitions of the two movements and then give you a brief overview of how they interplay. So both reproductive justice and environmental justice are rooted in social justice. Marginalized populations, including people of color, indigenous people, those who are differently abled, poor people, and queer people, suffer injustices that are cumulative. They are more likely to suffer from reproductive oppression and more likely to suffer the harms of environmental degradation. Marginalized people are also less likely to have a seat at the table when decisions are being made about their lives, and we know that justice requires participation. Reproductive justice is a response to the fact that women of color, low-income women, and younger women don't just face attacks on their right to access abortion and contraception. Their right to bear and raise children are also constantly under attack. RJ addresses the fact that multiple forms of social oppression and discrimination keep individuals from being able to have and raise healthy families. Policies are crafted specifically to discourage childbearing by certain undesirable classes of people and to encourage childbearing by the favored classes. And we see this play out in social policy all the time. We see child tax credits, and then we see a extra child penalty for women who are receiving public assistance. So our movement addresses the broader spectrum of reproductive concerns by supporting the right of individuals to have the children they want, to raise the children they have, and to plan their families through safe, legal access to abortion and contraception. So the concept of reproductive justice was developed by women of color attending the 1994 International Conference on Population and Development in Cairo. Asian communities for reproductive justice quickly adopted and helped shape and refine the concept, and then other women of color organizations such as Sister Song started making it their framework also. And more recently, we're actually seeing allied organizations like the one I work for, the National Women's Law Center, adopt the framework as well. Well, why? Because we are seeing a continuum of oppressive measures taken against people through policies that affect sexuality and reproduction, from contraception to abortion to birthing rights, to marriage equality, to attacks on single parenting, to claims that child care is harmful to children, so women need to go home. All of these efforts to control and restrict reproduction and sexuality are all interrelated, and so we're so much stronger if we actually recognize the connection and draw new allies to our common movement. The environmental justice movement seeks to reduce the inequitable environmental burdens borne by people of color, women, indigenous communities, and those living in economically disadvantaged areas or developing nations. Yeah. The term environmental racism evolved in the 1990s to describe the disproportionate effect that people of color suffer from environmental degradation. The cure for environmental racism, environmental justice, is defined as the fair treatment and meaningful involvement of all people, regardless of race, color, sex, national origin, or income, with respect to the development, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. So both movements were actually developed in response by the failure of the original mainstream movements to actually address the concerns of those who are living at the margins. Unfortunately, mainstream movements of each came to be associated with class privilege. So the environmental rights movement, that was seen as being an upper-class issue. The reproductive rights movement, women of color felt very excluded from that movement. They said, it doesn't address my concerns. But as a response, these two movements that are rooted in social justice sought to reclaim these universal rights for everyone. Unfortunately, we know that reputations die hard. I had mentioned this example in the webinar that me and Kim raised, but I think it's just so appropriate. So a few years ago, I was at a meeting with a bunch of reproductive justice advocates, and that meeting happened to fall on Earth Day. So as an icebreaker, our convener asked us to go around the room and say what Earth Day meant to us. This is from a group of incredibly progressive women, and they said things like, tree-hugging, Prius-driving, yuppie scum. That's what Earth Day and the environmental movement invoked for them. we had a little education moment to try to bring them up to speed that the environmental movement actually has evolved to being more concerned with people than with polar bears, and that these things aren't necessarily mutually exclusive. So it's really kind of shocking to me. So at the outset, the one intersection is obvious. We know that the environment affects reproduction. So we know that infertility is sometimes caused by environmental factors. So it can limit, the environment can actually limit people's ability to have the children they want. We also know that the environment affects women's health during pregnancy and can have a severe impact on birth outcomes. And of course, it should not be controversial to say that every child should have the right to be raised in a healthy environment. Conversely, we also know that reproduction affects the environment. But this argument has actually been used to further the reproductive oppression of people of color by scapegoating them for environmental degradation. It is unfortunate that population control is still seen by some as a solution to our planet's problems. But the environmental justice movement distinguishes itself by rejecting immigration or overpopulation as the cause of environmental problems. EJ recognizes that pervasive racism has contributed to the common misperception that environmental problems are caused by too many black and brown people and a lack of adequate resources to sustain their population. In fact, lack of resources can be directly attributed to the exploitation of certain nations by richer, more powerful countries. Both EJ and RJ reject any solution to problems of poverty and environmental degradation that focuses solely on individual choices and fails to address the actual root systemic problems that give rise to what we see in environmental degradation. Improved socioeconomic and environmental conditions result in reduced infant and maternal mortality. We know that women voluntarily choose to limit their childbearing when they are granted access to education and when their socioeconomic status improves. Studies also show that birth rates decrease when women are confident that their children will survive infancy. Seems like common sense. RJ supports solutions promoted by the environmental justice movement that go beyond mere efforts to limit childbearing and that actually empower women to make their own decisions so their families can thrive. Use of contraceptives allows for longer spacing between births, greatly improving both maternal and fetal health, and allowing families to devote more resources to each individual child. Interestingly enough, we have seen that some who oppose contraception have actually tried to gain support from environmental justice advocates by claiming that contraceptives are bad for the environment. How? Think about this. They've actually distorted the facts about estrogens found in drinking water. And a few years back, I think it was John Stewart had this fantastic segment about some conservative environmental activists claiming that Lady P was causing fish to be intersexed. Just in the same stuff. So the facts are that 90% of the hormones in the water supply can actually be traced to industrial farming practices, and less than 1% of the estrogens found in water can be attributed to estrogens excreted by humans in that unfortunately named Lady Peach. But of course we have to ask, who else is tired of the attacks on contraception? Really sick of the attacks on contraception. This is just another attempt to divide and conquer our movement and to actually try to peel off other progressives for a conservative cause, and that is opposing contraception. Let's not fall for this attempt to divide and conquer. And it's also worthwhile to note that women have been at the forefront of the environmental justice movement, as we see here today. Perhaps this is because women and children suffer more serious health effects and social consequences from environmental hazards. This is because women, as primary caretakers, are the ones who are most likely to bear the burden of caring for children who are harmed by polluted air and are staying home from school with asthma. And we know the right of all women to have healthy pregnancies and raise children in a healthy environment is a core principle that unites both RJ and EJ. And finally, these movements converge in women's bodies. As low-wage workers, women and people of color are disproportionately exposed to many hazardous chemicals, including agricultural pesticides, home and industrial cleaning products, and chemicals used in hair and nail salons. But men, also take note, and we do have men in the audience, I'm happy to see, you are not immune from these harms. Exposure to certain chemicals can actually cause a host of reproductive health problems, such as infertility and reproductive cancers in both men and women. So I thank you for being here today and your interest in figuring out how our movements can combine to advance our common goals and so that we can become less silos in our work. Thank you. I look forward to our discussion.
Just switching out the cord here. Give me a second, a little technical moment.
I hurt.
So while that's happening, I'm going to do a little pop quiz because y'all don't have enough of those in your lives, I'm sure. How many of you drank out of a plastic water bottle today? Okay. How many of you took a shower and maybe had a little herbal essences, a little Pantene Pro-V, some Bath & Body products? Doesn't have to be those brands, but, you know, there was some kind of, you know, product you bought at a CVS, okay? If you didn't raise your hand, no one's here to judge you, but maybe later you can take care of that. Okay. How many of you talked on a cell phone today?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. How many of you have slept on IKEA furniture in the past month?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Did anyone not raise their hand?
Right.
All right. So.
Wow.
Between those.
Where has he been?
Where? No showering, no sleeping.
Too smelly guy.
Too many
in the
classes.
That's what air in the bed.
Okay. So I'll just kind of make a face and that works. All right. So the purpose of that exercise was just to give a sense of what are the kinds of products that we're all using every day. And in a few moments, it'll become clear why I did that. So first, I'm Kimberly. I'm with the National Latina Institute for Reproductive Health. I'm very excited to be working for an organization whose focus is reproductive justice and an organization that really looks at intersections in a whole host of ways. We work on LGBTQ issues. We are now starting to explore environmental justice. We work on immigration, racial discrimination, a whole host of issues that affect Latinas. I personally have been working on the issue of environmental and reproductive justice for several years, including at my former job. So I'm starting to kind of feel like Al Gore because I had this PowerPoint that I'm now taking from place to place. And I love that I get to see Jill and Michelle at many of those places. Great thing about doing intersectional work, you get to see the same people. So I'm going to talk kind of broadly about some issues of environmental and reproductive health, but also, given my kind of new organizational role, put a little bit more of a spin on how it impacts Latina communities in particular. Next slide. Okay, so just to reiterate, the reproductive justice framework, often I think what happens when we talk about reproductive rights, they get so focused on contraception and abortion, in part because we're fighting such terrible battles, is we forget the other pieces of women's reproductive lives. And we know that that includes the right to have a child and the right to parent the children that we have. Next slide. Okay. Maybe you just got to click a couple more times. I really like animations. So I think that, one more. So I think Jill did a really great job of illustrating the ways in which the right has tried to co-opt this intersection. So, you know, we know in this room that there's so much to be gained by collaboration between women of color groups who are focused on reproductive justice and folks who are looking at environmental justice. But the other side has taken note that environmentalism is a good way to sell things, right? And so they're using it to sell products, and they're using it to sell ideology. And that ideology directly goes against the interests of people of color frequently. And so that includes some of this rhetoric that you've heard. There are groups who purport to be environmental groups that are really just anti-immigration groups. And so they're trying to put a new spin on that. Jill talked about the great example of all of these attacks on birth control as an environmental pollutant. when we know that the big environmental pollutants are things like factory farming, unregulated industry, but they don't get attacked on a regular basis, right? Birth control seems to be the punching bag again and again. And I think, also this idea of overpopulation, particularly as overpopulation that's attributed to to black and brown women having too many babies, right? So there's a lot of, unfortunately, environmental rhetoric that gets misused against communities of color, which is particularly disturbing given that we know that communities of color face the worst consequences and disproportionately are impacted by environmental degradation, often that they did not cause or have anything to do with. Next slide. Just give it a couple clicks. One more. Okay, so Jill already defined what environmental and reproductive justice are. I don't need to do that again. But I do want to point out the many different kind of ways that environmental justice and reproductive justice intersect in our day-to-day lives. So what are the issues that sort of sit at the nexus here? We have clean air, healthy food, safe workplaces, toxic-free products, climate justice, and community and public health. So there are a whole host of opportunities for advocacy, for your work as future attorneys, for your work in a whole lot of different areas that we can find collaboration across these two movements. Okay, so I'm going to talk about some sexual and reproductive health trends. And this is the part where I get to scare everybody, because that's really fun for me. So trends of the last 50 years have shown that reproductive health in America and globally, to a certain extent, particularly in Europe, reproductive health is on the decline. Infertility has doubled among women ages 18 to 25. Many of you in this room are in that category, and that's really scary. It's not explainable. Often you'll hear talk about infertility as, oh, well, that's just older women, waiting to have kids until they're in their late 30s and their 40s. Infertility is on the rise in much younger women as well. We've seen a decline in sperm counts. Once again, men are not immune. You can clip that three more times. We've seen early puberty on the rise, especially for Latina and black girls. We're seeing girls as young as 7 going through puberty, and that brings with it a whole host of health as well as social consequences. We're seeing a rise in reproductive tract abnormalities in newborn boys. Without getting too terribly graphic, there is a condition called hypospadias in which the urethra, which is supposed to come out at the end of the penis, either doesn't come out or comes out at a different point on the penis. That's not how it's supposed to be, right? This used to be a very rare congenital birth defect. We're seeing it now in as many as 1 in 300 baby boys. We're also seeing endometriosis increasing, particularly for black women. As well, we see persistent health disparities in breast and cervical cancer diagnosis and death, again, particularly having an impact on black women and Latinas. Okay, so we know that reproductive health is on the decline. Why? First, we can look at all of the different ways that the environment impacts our health. So again, kind of thinking at what lies at the intersection between reproductive and environmental health, we know that on a day-to-day basis, we use a whole bunch of different products at home. They may or may not be safe and healthy, right? We know that, we've all heard of some of the scandals that have happened recently with contaminated food, with food containers. We have the air, land, and water that we share, and we know particularly for communities of color, their air, land, and water looks very different from the air, land, and water in this beautiful neighborhood here. We know that there are workplace exposures, particularly for, again, communities of color, and with a focus on Latinas. Many of the jobs that Latinas find themselves in are more dangerous. For example, working as migrant workers, you're exposed to a lot of pesticides. Working as domestic workers, you're exposed on a day-to-day basis, all day long, to all sorts of cleaning chemicals. Have you ever gotten dizzy after cleaning your bathroom for an hour? Imagine if you did that for 60 hours a week. We also know that our ability to sort of stave off or deal with environmental assaults on our health has to do with how our health is to begin with, right? So if we know that there are populations that already experience difficulty accessing healthcare, that are already experiencing health disparities, they're going to be less able to absorb all of the kind of environmental threats that they're being bombarded with. Okay, so back to that question about why reproductive health is on the decline. Something you might be interested in knowing is that there are currently 84,000 chemicals in commerce being used in the U.S. every single day. They're in your chair, they're in your water bottle, they're in electronics, they're in food containers, they're everywhere, 84,000. Of those, only 200 have ever been tested for the effects on human health. So that means that you are surrounded by touching, putting things near your mouth, on your body, that contain chemicals that have never been tested to see if they're safe, to see if they cause cancer, to see if they cause hypospadias. And of those, in the great history of our fine nation, only five have ever been regulated. Five. So, I don't know them all by heart. That's a good question.
Dioxins. Things like dioxins, the
lead,
mercury. It's only five, but you can go to a website called saferchemicals.org.
Yes.
Sign up and keep going.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
And even the five that have been regulated have not been regulated in all products. And that's one of the problems. So we have a big chemical mess. We don't really know the effect on human health, but we do know that reproductive health is on the decline.
PBT.
We're going to start connecting the dots. Okay? Give me like four clicks. Okay. So these are some of the reproductive health conditions that are rising. They're increasing. Now, what do we know about them? You can click a whole bunch. Sorry, there's lots of kinds of animations. Each of these conditions has been tied by repeated, robust, and very well-done scientific evidence has been linked to specific chemicals. Now, you'll see the list of chemicals on the right, formaldehyde. Some of you guys might have done frog dissection, right? You remember the stuff that kept the frogs in? Something called PFOA, something called BPA, something called phthalates. Now, those look like some really crazy chemicals that you might find in like a science lab, right? Wrong. Each of those chemicals is probably found in a product that you use today. Formaldehyde is found in a lot of furniture, so that IKEA furniture you might have been sleeping on. PFOA is a chemical that's found in Teflon pans. The reason that they first figured out that Teflon pans might be dangerous is because a lot of people keep birds in their kitchens, and Teflon pan, when you heat Teflon, that material that makes it so lovely and nonstick actually vaporizes, gets into the air. People's birds were dying. So, like canary in a coal mine in a very literal sense. The response of the company that makes Teflon when, for example, I posted a blog about this and the danger of this particular chemical, right? It was killing birds, you know, it gets into your food. Their response was, don't keep your bird in your kitchen. but you keep cooking, you know, your little stir fry and eat it. But at least if you blog about PFOA, they will have a company representative commenting on your blog within like 15 minutes. They're amazing, very well funded folks.
Can we test that out right here? On Twitter right now?
I would love to see
awesome.
That. Absolutely, yes. Tweet it up. BPA is a chemical that some of you may have heard of. Raise your hand if you've heard of BPA. It's been found in baby bottles. It's been found in many of the water bottles you have in front of you. It's been found in the lining of canned foods. It's one of the more ubiquitous chemicals. And then a chemical called phthalates. Phthalates are very frequently found in anything that smells nice and pretty. So Bath and Body Works, a lot of the kind of shampoo, body wash, that sort of stuff, contains phthalates. And give us a couple more clicks. So we've got health problems, we've got the chemicals, and we've got everyday products that they're using. Okay, so we know that the chemicals are in the products we're using. We know that they've been linked in scientific experiments to health problems, but how do we know that they're in our bodies? There's something called biomonitoring that tells us that, in fact, yes, these chemicals get into our blood, our urine, our tissue. This is Molly Gray. She's a real person. She's a mom from Seattle. Total hippie crunchy, right? Like, does yoga, ate organic her whole life, big fan of whole foods.
Drives a Prius.
Drives a Prius, probably. I mean, you know, probably hasn't had pants. Who knows? But but she had a lot of trouble conceiving. And as she was having trouble conceiving, she thought, you know, I've lived healthy my whole life. I don't get it. Why am I having trouble having kids? So she did all this research and started to learn about all of these chemicals, like some of the ones I just showed you, that are in things we use every day, right, and that are related to reproductive health problems. Well, eventually, when she finally got pregnant, she had herself tested to see how many chemicals were in her body. A couple more clicks. She was tested for 13 chemicals and tested positive for every single one. Spent her whole life trying to live healthy, but at some point, you're breathing the air, you're sitting on furniture, you're drinking out of a water bottle. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I'm actually just going to, you can give like four clicks. I'm not going to go into detail because we have the expert on Mossville in the house, so I'm going to let her do it.
Sweet. Thanks for a shout-out for Mossville.
Oh, I only have a shout-out for Mossville.
Yeah.
So
Knoxville,
as a community, actually is a very inspiring story. It was founded by freed slaves who wanted to create a space for their children to have a better future. Unfortunately, the 400 families that live there are surrounded by 14 industrial facilities that pump out 4 million pounds of toxic chemicals annually. And not surprisingly, folks that live there who are literally besieged by chemical plants report high rates of reproductive health problems. Okay, so a quick little science lesson on how chemicals hurt us, and particularly why chemicals in everyday products have such a profound impact on reproductive health specifically. And it's because they can trick our bodies into thinking that they're supposed to be there. They are the Trojan horses. Endocrine disrupting chemicals are the Trojan horses of the chemical world. And what they do, give us two clicks. You'll see that little blue star there. So that is a normal hormone. Let's say it's in my body and it's an estrogen hormone, right? And it's telling my cell to do something, you know, as in the normal course of sort of human biology. The little red thing on the right acts like estrogen and makes your cell think that it's estrogen. So for example, if you're a very young girl and your body isn't naturally producing its own estrogen yet because you haven't properly gone through puberty, but you're exposed to a chemical that acts like estrogen, it could trigger early puberty. So this is the part where everybody gets overwhelmed and says, oh my God, I'm going to live in a bubble. But then you're like, what's the bubble? Plastic. So the good news, everybody takes a deep breath. The good news, there are things you can do in your daily life.
That's right.
And there are policy solutions to this. We have solutions. It's amazing. There are ways to get chemicals out of our world, out of our workplaces. We just have to get them passed. So just to quickly run through, give us another click. The two laws that govern chemicals are from 1976 to 1938. They're very old and out of date. The chemicals that are around today are very different from those that were around 30, 40, 50 years ago. We need new laws. The good news is that the states are not waiting for the federal government to get around to doing its job. As many of you know, the federal government's having some problems with that these days. But many states are passing their own, they're passing BPA bans, they're passing their own kind of toxics regulation. That's really great work. But if you think about it, we have 50 states and 84,000 chemicals, right? I'm not really good at math, but I think that'll take a long time to ban all the bad ones. So I would urge you to find ways to advocate for and participate in the work moving towards federal chemical policy reform, particularly a law called the Toxic Chemicals Safety Act, or the Safe Chemicals Act if you speak Senate. Introduced and championed by Senator Lautenberg. It is legislation that would actually require, you know, crazy idea, that we test chemicals to see if they're safe before we put them in, you know, baby bottles and blue jeans. So you can click past this. So just to give sort of reiterate a couple ways that you can get involved on a local and national level. There's all kinds of great organizations who are doing this work, and many of them are up here in front of you today. Check out safecosmetics.org, check out livingdownstream.com. There's a state group. The big national coalition is the Safer Chemicals Healthy Families Coalition. All of these groups are working on reducing the number of dangerous chemicals in our environments. We know that this will help us all. We know that it will help communities of color even more. And I hope that you'll consider getting involved.
Thank you so much. So I'm a storyteller, so I'm going to tell a story. How's that?
Okay.
Like midday.
Let's
go. And we had lunch. And you had these wonderful presentations, which were great. Thank you so very much. And just to piggyback off of the Toxic Substance Control Act, better known as Safer Chemicals Act by Senator Lautenberg, I just heard the other day that they're hoping to take a floor vote in April. And so if you are, we really need for you to sign up to one of those groups, Safer Chemicals, Healthy Families, Safe Cosmetics. We're both intertwined. I'm a member of both. I promoted a lot on my Facebook, but we're going to need to hit the ground running because this really does impact, as you heard, the environmental justice community, to which I will begin my story today. 9 out of 10 communities of color specifically live in toxic environments. Toxic environments where there is production and or disposal. In their particular communities, on top of that, those things, that products which you heard our friends talk about, Kimberly talked about. How did this happen? This, when we go all the way back, we'll go all the way back, and I'll tell you a story about Mossville, which is an incredible, 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 incredible community that I've just grown to love so very much and call my dear family. It's in Louisiana. It was formed by freed people. They were not freed slaves. We're just going to have a little lesson here, because slavery, when you walk out of that thing and create your own thing, you are no longer enslaved.
Right. Thank you.
We are free. Please be free now. And so five families, think about this, in 1790s, because all of these things ring important and ring true in understanding the fact why we need to push the envelope for that of a human rights, a rights-based approach, which is why we have our RJ folks in the house. Who's our RJ folks?
Yeah,
and our EJ folks, and we all intertwine, because we've been intertwined since the very beginning, but don't let the system fool you that we weren't, right? Because when we go all the way back to those 1790s, we were fighting for rights. We were fighting for rights of families. We were fighting for the rights to have healthy communities. We were fighting for our very right to be free. And some of my white brothers and sisters in here, you were fighting too, unbeknownst to yourselves. Some of you were. You know, you were fighting for your right to be have families, for your right to be free, for your right to have healthy communities. And so in 1790s, the community of Mossville was formed, just slightly outside of Lake Charles, Louisiana, just across the Gulf from Beaumont and Houston and what have you. And they tell me then, as they say now, there's oil in them parts. Okay? But it was founded by, we know how history can distort itself in this here country. It was founded by five communities, five folk who walked out of slavery, where they had already laid their lives down in other places and started a life in anew. They told us Ernest Hemingway used to go there and hunt and fish and muse, because it was, past tense, the most pristine and holistic and biodiverse in all of Louisiana. So don't let them twist you with these environmental, and they're my friends and I love them dearly, but we've been holding on to sustainable, healthy, green communities for a long time. 1790, remember, there were grapefruit trees and all those things. And then, by the way, it's an unincorporated community. Then comes the industry in the 50s. We all know what was happening in the 50s. We still had Jim Crow, was the biggest legacy there was. But in the meantime, there were folks pushing for deeper and further rights. And so we had industries coming in. We had this quote, New Deal, just finished New Deals and all these things. And here comes some refineries and say, we're going to locate here. One by the name of Esso, put a tiger in the tank. I'm telling my age now, but it's been Exxon. And they said, we're going to locate here in Louisiana, but we need a little help here. You know, it's called social welfare. And so we located without having to pay taxes. And to this day, they don't pay taxes. Social welfare? I don't know. So anyway, since that time now, that was along the Gulf of Mexico, 85-mile stretch, now has grown to over 136 petrochemical refineries, industries, nuclear, natural gas, you name it, they have it. But guess what they don't have? The money. They don't have the jobs. They have the toxic pollution, and they tell me it's the law. Why is it the law? Because of the fact that they are an unincorporated community. We have environmental regulations that speak to the fact that we need technological fixes to take care of things in order to for us to push this here economy, and an economy that collapsed in the good old South with respect to slavery, but then was enhanced by that of industry. And now who's still bearing the brunt of the burden? Black and brown people. It's the law, they tell me. They have the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, and all these here acts, that Toxic Substance Control Act, but you see it's broken.
But I'm here with some good news, because you all are law students and I'm not. You all are lawyers and I'm not. I just came here with some hope for you. And to give you a little information, because I learned from two lawyers that I work with, the co-directors of Advocates for Environmental Human Rights, www.ehumanrights.org. I learned from them, and I learned from the environmental justice movement, which began in the 1980s, that we have human rights. We have human rights that we can push for based on the American Declaration of the Rights and Duties of Man. Women are supposed to be protected, their health. They should be able to raise healthy, viable children in healthy communities. It is for that fact, and that, not only that fact, but other reasons, based on human rights laws, one being that of Executive Order 13107, that says that our policies must be able to speak to the fact that we are to be able to create, not have disparities, but your human right to health, life, and freedom of discrimination should be protected. However, we don't, that's in the drawer somewhere. Right now, we're grappling and fighting for civil rights, and don't get me wrong, I am very respectful and humble and honored for the fact that we are indeed fighting for civil rights, but we have a backlog of cases, and my dear friend Bernice Miller Travis can attest to that, that are backlogged back to 30 years from past, right? Some of the folks have died, some of the children have grown up, and yet we still do not have these things passed. So as a result, Advocates for Environmental Human Rights took, for the first time ever, a petition to the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights in 2005 on behalf of the Mossville Environmental Environmental Action Now and the community residents of Mossville. We learned not long ago that that petition, we have grounds for admissibility. The first time ever, which we are challenging that, of the legal regulatory framework structure of the United States and how it upholds the rights of life, health, and freedom of discrimination. But I'm here to also remind my dear colleagues and friends from the environmental movement on, as we speak to that of the need for sustainability and all these things, this was a dream that our dearly beloved Dr. King had when he spoke to the need for the beloved community. And from that birthed, the environmental justice movement continued on. That train continued on. The train continued on to the fact that we must indeed have healthy communities. These pesticides came in the 1950s because of the fact, again, now that we didn't have that of the labor force, you know those folks want to get paid. They don't want to be slaves no more. So here comes the most toxic pesticides ever. Then they in turn turn into biological warfare, which we wind up having to have things such as the Stockholm Convention come to play. Speaking to persistent organic pollutants that are lingering in each of our bodies today. However, Mossville has three times the amount in their blood, soil, urine. They can no longer fish the bayous. They can no longer live in the ways in which they live. So we are now challenging for them to have health care, for them to be able to, with toxicological services, free. But the government tells them they have to pay. Haven't they paid enough? We're against that of war. And why? Because of the fact that when you look at these chemicals that are being used in war, it impacts not only our bodies, but it also impacts the very communities that these folks are living in and around, because you have to dispose of it somewhere, and guess where they're being disposed of? So we are sick and tired of being a dumping ground, and then told that we must live sustainably, when guess what? We've been living sustainably all along. We tried to tell you that. even as women such as, and I'm going to end on this note because I need to, this is how I got started. I'm a biologist by trade, but my whole family was the help. And then when the man died, my Aunt Loretta went from being the help to having to be forced into working in a segregated military shop where she put together bombs right up in Elkton, Maryland. I buried my aunt 1 month after Katrina because she had urethral cancer. And oh, by the way, my aunt had hysterectomy. And oh, by the way, her husband had a brain tumor and he died too. They never had children. I ask you today, for those of you who are law students and those of you who are lawyers, to push the envelope. We must push our government to uphold our human right to a healthy and safe community. And that is why the RJ and EJ community get down the way they do. We are fighting for our lives. And I thank you so very much for fighting with us. Go to saferchemicals.org. You can contact us, Advocates for Environmental Human Rights, if you want to volunteer to be a law interns with Natalie and Monique down in New Orleans. We could certainly use you. And I just wish you well, and please push your congressman and your senator to do the right thing with this Toxic Control Act. And oh, by the way, that Keystone Pipeline ain't dead. So we're going to really need you all on this to really push the envelope. Thank you so very much.
For joining you so late. I am taking a plane at 4:30, and of course everybody and their mama wanted to talk to me before I get on that plane. So I'm sorry to be late and have missed the previous panelists, but I know that they brought some extraordinary knowledge to this conversation. And so I'm the cleanup hitter, and I want to sort of tie these pieces together while also placing it in a historical context and helping you to understand sort of the history of this struggle and how it continues to manifest itself, and hopefully ways that you think and hear from what we've talked about and what I talk about, ways that you can intersect with this work in the course of your own research, your own advocacy, your own legal careers going forward. So I know there was a little bit of discussion about the history of the EJ movement, and since I was there from the beginning, I thought maybe I would put that in some brighter relief and context, and particularly talk about the role of women in the evolution of this social movement, and perhaps you can see from that role why issues of reproductive justice and reproductive rights and reproductive health have always been such important components of the evolution of the movement for environmental justice. So. Really, it depends on who you talk to, right? There is no actual sort of point on a map where you can start and sort of go forward linearly and say, you know, this was the beginning and this is where we are now, because it depends on whose community you talk to. If you talk to tribal communities, particularly reservation-based tribal communities, they could tell you about struggles around land rights and sovereignty that we also consider a strong part of the environmental justice movement, as well as struggles for the very integrity of women's bodies who were Native American. They can tell you that that struggle goes back for hundreds and hundreds of years. So if you ask tribal communities, they don't point to the 1970s or the 1980s. They point to millennia of struggle around this issue. If you were to ask the African-American community, it depends on where you're asking, but if you're asking communities in the Deep South who had much more of a relationship to the land and to the institution of slavery, they would tell you that that struggle started when they began to establish free colored communities right after the end of slavery, in the case of Mossville and Lake Charles, Louisiana, actually before the formal end of the institution of slavery. If you were to ask Latinas and the Latino community when the struggle for environmental justice began for them, they can also take you back at least half a millennia to talk about the struggle for land rights and sovereignty and the integrity of communities and the integrity of women's bodies in those communities. And so it depends on who you ask where it starts. But in the modern era, we tend to refer to a particular struggle in Warren County, North Carolina, in the early 1980s, where this community in particular found themselves the unwitting host for a hazardous waste incinerator, a determination that was made by the state of North Carolina and their local county government without any consultation with the local community. And so what had been happening in Warren County, North Carolina, which is really just across the Virginia-North Carolina border on Highway 85, if you're familiar with this part of the country, is that for some reason there was a practice of bringing PCB-contaminated soil and dumping it along the highway in this community. We don't know why. We don't know what made the folks who were transporting that contaminated soil to determine that they should dump it on the side of the highway in this community, but they did, and they did for many, many years. And so I suppose in the wisdom of the state of North Carolina, they determined, well, since somebody determined that this was a good place to dump it, let's actually make a hazardous waste landfill in the same community, and let's just move the contaminated soil into the hazardous waste landfill. The problem was they consulted not a single person who lived in the community. The county is 85% African American. It is part of the Black Belt of North Carolina, where the majority of African Americans in the state of North Carolina live. And a number of women who were members of the United Church of Christ determined that this was a real injustice and that they were going to lay their bodies down in front of the trucks who were trying to bring the contaminated soil into this landfill. And so launched the first formal activity that anybody can actually articulate and say this was the beginning of the environmental justice movement. And the reason that people say that is because what the people were calling for was an end to environmental racism. They coined that term there in Warren County, North Carolina. What they experienced was that a decision and determinations were being made about the quality of life for the people who lived there, but the people who lived there were not invited to be a part of that decision-making process. But that was not necessarily the case in counties where the majority of the population was white. No matter the income, if you were white, you seemed to at least be invited into a conversation about what was going to happen where you live. Now, you might not be able to determine the outcome of that decision depending on your class status, but you certainly would know that it was happening. And so they began to organize and mobilize, and it was mostly children and mostly women who were engaged in the struggle. And they reached out to the Commission for Racial Justice at the United Church of Christ, where I happened to be a research assistant at the time. And they asked the United Church of Christ Commission for Racial Justice to look into this phenomena of bringing this hazardous waste incinerator and this hazardous waste landfill to Warren County. Was there something unique to their county? Was there something about their hydrology that made them, you know, particularly susceptible to this development? Was there something about sort of the landmass of the county? What was it about Warren County that made the state of North Carolina determined to take on this particular land use? And so we undertook this study that we call the Special Project on Toxic Injustice. And so when I got to the commission, it was 1985. They had been talking about and preparing and beginning to do this research when I got there. We published a report in 1987 entitled Toxic Waste and Race in the United States, and it was the first report to document the relationship between race and the location of hazardous waste. And what we found in our research was that race proved to be the most statistically significant indicator in where hazardous waste sites were located. It continues to be. It happened to turn out to be a landmark piece of research. We didn't know that at the time. We also didn't know how statistically significant this relationship between waste and the location of hazardous waste would be. So I think it's important for you to have that understanding and to have the understanding that not only in Warren County, North Carolina, but in thousands of communities, particularly communities of color and low-income communities, and tribal communities across the U.S., it was women who stepped up to take on this task. They didn't know what they were taking on. They didn't know what they were encountering. They didn't know how deep the problem was. They didn't know how systemic the problem was. They didn't know that they would eventually have to be having a one-on-one conversation with the President of the United States about what was happening in their communities. They had no idea the depth of the source of the problem. What they knew was that they were sick, their families were sick, their children were sick, the land around them where they lived at was not well, the quality of the water, if they were lucky enough to have indoor plumbing, that the quality of the water was not drinkable, that the air did not smell well, that food did not grow, in some communities grass would not grow because of their proximity to hazardous waste nearby or sources of pollution. This is what they sort of stumbled upon, not because they didn't have anything else to do, but the most primary and important thing for them in their lives was to make sure that they and their loved ones were okay. And what they were noticing is that everything was not okay, that something was seriously amiss. And once those women began to organize and to mobilize, now there were a lot of men, but if you look through the annals of the environmental justice movement, you will see the name of quite a few men, you know, in leadership positions, not unlike the traditional civil rights movement. But when you actually look and see who built the organizations, who staffed the organizations, who did the organizing, who did the research, it's thousands of women. Not dozens of women, but thousands of women across this country. Thousands of women. And mostly, they came to the table around issues of reproductive rights. Though at the time, they didn't know that that was why they were coming to the table either. So I'll tell you a story about two organizations. One is my own organization in New York, but another, how much time do I have?
7 minutes.
7 minutes. Another is about an organization called the Newtown Florists Club. And the Newtown Florists Club is from they're from Gainesville, Florida. And the Florists Clubs, I'll tell you a little bit of history in the African-American community. I'd say in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, 1920s, 30s, and 40s, whenever black families had to bury someone, frequently when someone died, they didn't have the resources to have a funeral. And so they created these funeral societies where people would come together and amass their resources and funeralize whomever it was. So you would do it for the whole community, but you would pool your resources to do that. So the person would have a nice homegoing service, they would have a casket, they would have a burial plot, they would have a headstone, and they would have flowers. And the flowers were really, really, really important. And so the Newtown Florists Club was one of those black burial societies that had come into being in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. And so they were going about their normal business, and they started to notice that they were getting a lot of requests for flowers. That, like, a lot of people were dying. And a lot of people were dying around the same time. And then when they sort of looked a little further into it, you know, you're used to, or more used to, burying the elderly. Mm-hmm. That's sort of the cycle of life, right? But they were burying children, they were burying toddlers, they were burying teenagers, mm-hmm. they were burying women in the prime of their life, men in the prime of their life, and they couldn't quite understand what was going on, but they knew that something was amiss. And so they began to look further in it, and they found that there were seven sources of toxic contamination underground feeding into the drinking water supply of this community. And so people have been drinking contaminated water for God only knows how long. But they backed into the issue because in the context of the sort of community service that they normally did, they found that there was just an inordinate amount of people who were dying in this particular part of Gainesville, Florida. I could tell you for hours on end stories just like that in tribal communities, in historic Latino communities, in immigrant communities, in African-American communities, and the one thing that everyone has in common seems to be the color of their skin. It's happening in middle-class communities of color, it's happening in affluent communities of color, in the black Hollywood, which is called Baldwin Hills in Los Angeles. They have the only operating oil field in the state of California, in an inner-city area. Well, it's not inner-city, it's the black Hollywood. And there is the oil field right in the back of everyone's property. And they were trying to build a power plant there as well. And folks came together and beat that back. But I could tell you stories upon stories upon stories. And in each case, there would be women who had really risen to the occasion, well beyond their capacity,
well beyond their knowledge base. This is not what they started out to do in life, and I'm a living testament. I did not start out to be an environmentalist. I started out to be a civil rights advocate, and I was presented with this research at the United Church of Christ, and I said, well, this is the civil rights issue of the 20th and 21st century. This is it. Because if you don't have the right to access to a safe and healthy environment in which to live, it doesn't matter. All of your other rights are abrogated because you don't have the right to live a safe and healthy life. Lastly, I want to share with you some information just sort of about the public policy dimensions of this work. And so as people began to organize about these issues and do their own research and begin to form coalitions with other groups who are working on these issues, they began to understand how absolutely frightening and terrifying the field of environmental injustice is, and that their very lives were being threatened at a fairly fundamental level. And so I am from New York, and I lived in northern Manhattan and Harlem most of my life until I moved to Prince William County in 1998. And in the context of doing my work at the United Church of Christ, I met some people who lived in my neighborhood in West Harlem, New York, who were fighting a sewage treatment plant. And that led to a long struggle. Suffice it to say that next month, the organization that I helped to start, West Harlem Environmental Action, will be celebrating our 24th year of existence. And 24 years ago, we could not have told you that, one, we would still be in existence, or two, that there would be so many environmental health assaults that we would be dealing with. And one of the things that we did, because there was such a prevalence of respiratory disease in the community, as we began to reach out to Columbia University School of Public Health to begin to do some really targeted research. And one of the things we partnered with was the Children's Environmental Health Center at Columbia University. And we did a lot of really tremendous research with this organization, not the least of which was a longitudinal study that looked at women who were pregnant and then followed the women and their children from in utero to 12 years old. And to figure out what is happening to these women, what are they being exposed to, what is it doing to them at a reproductive level, is the harm that they're experiencing from environmental exposures affecting their children and their children's development over time. And we found a number of really alarming things. I'm just going to tick off some of the research projects that we did. Mothers and Newborns Study, that's the study that I'm just talking about in northern Manhattan and the South Bronx. And here we were looking at all pregnant women in the study and their babies who were exposed to multiple common pollutants that can harm fetal and child development, respiratory health, or increase cancer risk. And it included exposure to PAHs and outdoor and indoor air. Another one of the big studies, and this one really blew my mind, was on fetal growth and neural behavioral development. And this was about exposure to pesticides. And so pesticides that are targeted and sold in bodegas and neighborhood stores in Black and Latino communities in northern Manhattan often are pesticides that have been banned. And there's been a lot of research about that lately in New York, particularly pesticides that are being sold at stores in the Chinatown community in New York City. And these pesticides have been banned from distribution and sale and circulation in the United States, yet they're still being sold in people's homes, and people are still using them. And those pesticides are having long-term impact on their reproductive health and on the health of their children, both in utero and as they are developing. So we looked at pesticides, PAH exposure, secondhand smoke exposure, phthalates, asthma risk, cancer risk, and found alarming, unbelievably alarming data. And I'll just leave you with this so you sort of understand the nature of the struggle. These communities, the South Bronx and Harlem and Washington Heights in northern Manhattan, have the highest premature death rate from asthma in the Western Hemisphere. So think about what you know about the Western Hemisphere, right? You know that Mexico City is in the Western Hemisphere, and they have really bad air quality, but apparently not as bad as the air quality in northern Manhattan, or in Chicago on the south side, or in Detroit on the southwest side, or in central Philly, or in Baltimore City, or in so many places around this country, that the threat to women's health, The threat to the integrity of women's lives is ever present. It's more present in communities of color, in low-income communities. And it's a battle that is too often not detected and not talked about in the broader environmental arena. But you should know that people are literally fighting for their very lives and their ability to continue to thrive in their communities, to continue to exist. It's a public health battle. It's a public policy battle. It's most definitely a legal battle in terms of enforcement, equal enforcement of environmental laws, which we don't see happening. It's a civil rights battle, and it's certainly, at its most fundamental, a reproductive rights battle. Thank you so much.
Take a moment, everybody who has to be at class at 1:30, if you want to go to class, as I need to tell you to do. Everybody else, we have a little bit of time, and I would love to take questions from the audience. Angie, are we recording? Do people need to speak into the mic for the...
I think it'll pick it up.
Not from the room as a whole, probably. So if people want to... Angie, do you want to MC with the question? You want to pass off the mic? I'll go ahead and open it up to the floor first, unless absolutely nobody asks a question, which seems unlikely. Oh, Angie, right behind you.
Thanks. Hi. I had a question. I know you kind of touched on this, Kimberly, but I was interested in sort of the role of food in all of this, because I think that, there have been linkages established to diet and breast cancer rates on the reproductive side, and then obviously on the environmental justice side, a huge issue is lack of access to healthy, whole foods. And I was kind of wondering what you guys think should be done or what is being done on the issue of food.
I'll offer a couple quick thoughts. So I think whenever we think about food, if we want to really bring that social justice lens, I want to think about not only the food that we eat, but also where our food is produced. As was mentioned earlier, one of the biggest contributors to water pollution is unregulated agriculture. Unfortunately, often the communities that are impacted by that low water quality are low-income communities and communities of color. So that's a little bit on the end of where the food's produced. In terms of quality of food and healthy food, just one sort of glimpse into how toxicochemicals figures into that. We know that, for example, canned fruits and vegetables are a big source of BPA, and one of the quickest ways to get BPA out of your body is to stop eating canned food. We also know that many of the most kind of toxic either body products or consumer products, that the plastics that use the ickiest stuff, are in places like dollar stores and are targeted towards communities of color, low-income communities. So I do think that, the kind of food that certain communities are exposed to is compounding not only their nutritional issues, but as well toxicochemical burden.
The other issue is that of genetically modified foods, and that's huge right now. And that's a big fight happening with our farm worker justice movement. And you can look to La Via Campesina, North America Farm Worker Justice Movement, and I would suggest that you actually hit their pages to follow what's happening now, because we're sending petitions to the White House as well as to government regulators because of the fact that one of Monsanto's folks just joined the Obama administration, unfortunately. And so, it's an unfortunate thing that we talk about, let's get fit, and then we have someone who is pro genetically modified seeds, if you will. And so we really need to change that system as well, because it, too, impacts our water streams and what have you, along with that of the agribusiness.
And I would just add that it's often hard to find common counsel among women of different racial and ethnic backgrounds, and certainly of different class backgrounds. But I think one of the things that could really unite us in a way that maybe nothing else has is
what is happening to the food supply, right? Mm-hmm. And what is going into the food at the front end, and also who's producing the food. So, you know, we tend to be, you know, fairly middle class in our analysis of this issue, right? So if it's Alar in the apple juice, or, you know, I'm a huge grape juice drinker, and now they're finding elevated levels of lead in apple juice and in grape juice. Mm-hmm. And so people tend to think, well, you know, we got to get the bottles right. We got to get the contaminants out of the juice, but they don't think about the people who are producing the food.
That's right.
And at the front end of the food cycle, the people are treated, you know, just like the soil in which they're growing the food, with not a whole lot of respect and not a lot of care for their health. And so people are literally being sprayed with pesticides. And it's not just the farm workers in the Central Valley in California.
Right.
It's the people who live in the agricultural South are sprayed daily by pesticide plants, who are dropping, you know, pesticides all over everywhere. If we could connect sort of how the food gets produced and what happens in the food cycle to the people at every end of that, that is the one thing that connects, you know, I think that has a real connective tissue and thread throughout our society. Everybody eats, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody eats
That's
food.
That's right.
You know, now some of us may not have access to great food. We may not have a lot of stores, but we all eat. And maybe if we could connect ourselves that way, it would make it easier for us to do the kind of mobilization and sort of public policy campaigns that we want, where we want everybody out in the streets. So we want everybody on Capitol Hill. We want everybody calling their members of Congress when they're, you know, the farm bill is going to be a mess.
Right.
And it is up for reauthorization now. People thought they had done a really good job, and they had, the last reauthorization of the farm bill. But now we get to deal with genetically modified foods. We get to deal with agricultural subsidies. We get to deal with all the inherent inequalities. Well, let's try to address in the farm bill the people who produce the food and making sure that it's safe and that the conditions in which the food that we all eat is safe so that we can be healthy. Because I personally, this is my personal belief, I think that there is no question that the rise in cancer and so many rare leukemias and other diseases in this society is directly connected to what we eat, mm-hmm. directly connected, and to the quality of that food and what's in that food. Mm-hmm. And I think there's a lot of fairly good research to document that.
I have a question. How consumer can be involved much more than just signing petitions or being part of campaigns? Like, can we trust labels, for example, or do we have to search for special providers or that kind of things for products?
I can speak to that. So unfortunately, the laws on labeling anything from, you know, body products to just daily things like you know, food containers or electronics. Labeling is very poor. What you can do is you can, whenever possible, try to opt for kind of safer products, you know, products that are labeled as BPA-free. A very easy thing that folks can do to protect your own health is don't put plastic in the microwave. It releases all the nasty chemicals that are in plastic right into your food. So keep plastic cool if you keep food in plastic. And I think there are some great websites you can check out. Saferchemicals.org actually has some great tips on what consumers can do to protect themselves. But I think it's really important to remember that you can't shop your way out of this problem. And even if you can find products that are safer for you, someone's still working in the plant that's making the crappy plastic and that's making the toxic, bottles. So I think, you know, it's good to do things to help our own health in the meantime, but we need systemic change.
But those consumer campaigns can be really, they can alter the course of history, right? I mean, safer fishing strategies for, you know, how to do mass fishing of tuna changed entirely because of, you know, consumers being made aware of how the tuna were being caught and what harm was happening to the fish stock and the fish supply. I think consumer campaigns in the U.S. are actually much more effective than all the other strategies that we try to apply, because when you get people to change their behavior and change it en masse, you really, you know, you drive everything that happens thereafter. So I think we have fallen away from consumer campaigns, and I think we need to go back to that. And I heard you talking when I was coming in about the hair care products, and there's just, I think there's no question that this is how a lot of women are being exposed to a lot of harmful chemicals. It's in the things that the cosmetics and the products that we put on our hair and our skin, and a consumer campaign about that could really change the production of those products. So I think we need to go back to some of that as effective strategies.
So I wanted to ask you
a question, about your everyday work, the things that you do every day, either you're lawyers or you work in policy. I heard Michelle talk about the Inter-American Commission case. I heard you all talking about different laws, but maybe you can talk a little bit about what you do to fight for what you're talking about. Thanks.
Do you want to just go in order and talk a little bit about your day-to-day work?
This isn't actually, so this, as I said, we developed this series as a part of outreach, but working on this specific issue as a policy matter is not a part of my day-to-day work, except to the extent where on occasion we'll see a policy that comes down regarding environmental health, and we will notice that it is very fetus-focused. Mm. And although we completely support the policy, we don't support the fetal focus, and we do some toying with the wording to make sure it's really talking about the healthy pregnancy as opposed to coming across as a fetal rights matter. That's where I think we are most active in it.
So my day-to-day involves going to the Hill, doing lobbying, trying to pull together coalitions to do things like sign-on letters. Sounds really mundane. Something that I'm involved in on this issue is trying to pull together new research and kind of repackaging research. We have to keep the media talking about this issue. We have to keep folks in Congress interested, and the way that you do that is by every 3 months, collaborating on, BPA in cans or, flame retardants in baby cribs. Like, you just have to keep churning out information. A lot of writing, information sharing.
So my day-to-day, my day-to-day goes day-to-day because I work with the communities that, I say this lovingly, I work with the communities that no one else really wants to take the full time to work with because it is a full time, right, Renee? I won't want to say no one wants to work with them because people do, but it takes a full time. And you know how you hear people, and I hate this line, they want to do the low-hanging fruit. Mm-hmm. I hate that because I have the really high fruit.
And she's short.
And I'm short. But, my day-to-day consists of being thankful for one thing, that I signed up to say yes, and that I have this deep-rooted passion for justice. I'm a biologist by trade, and I've watched what can happen to the earth, and I've listened to stories from, like, Carlos Morantes, who said that they lied to the farm workers and told them that that this pesticide was medicine for the plants, and that they would do better, and my families who have died, and the Mossville communities. And so I help to, first of all, keep their spirits up because they're working and living and fighting in this. And when the plant blows up, they're told to shelter in place, whereas I'm in my place and I might not be where they are, but I'm, you know what I mean? And so that said, then I channel that energy and I take it to places at times where I might have to challenge the head of ConocoPhillips, which I have, Jim Malva, and asked him, would you sleep in Mossville and have your family sleep there? Or I might have to challenge in a way which my colleagues might not want me to challenge, but the former head of the ATSDR, Dr. Frumkin, and who people thought that he was our best effort. And I was like, well, if he's our best effort, then damn it, I want better. And so I challenged him and almost probably got arrested if I went a little further.
He did lose his job.
But he did lose his job.
Okay.
But this is what people can do. But that's what I do on a daily basis, is that provide advocacy and support. I pray with people, sincerely. I cry with people. I raise hell for people. and I seek to speak truth to power for not only people, but for myself and for the children, especially because the children did not ask for this, and our elders expected more than that. And so that's what I do.
So I learned from the work that we began at West Harlem many years ago that a large part of what happens to folks is that there's a process and a public policy process and a decision-making process and a land use process going on, but the average person doesn't know that those processes are going on. And when they usually realize something serious is happening is when the bulldozers show up, or in our case, when they started building the $1.1 billion sewage treatment plant on our waterfront and we didn't have any parks. And now there's a park on top of the sewage treatment plant, I should say. I learned at that point that it wasn't that people didn't understand or that people didn't have the capacity to understand these complex issues. It's just that nobody had explained this is the process. And this is how you get in the process so that you can effectuate what happens in the process, or at least you can make a really good run at it. But people didn't know that the processes were actually happening. And so I went back to graduate school, to planning school, to try to really understand the planning process so that I could explain it to my own community so that we would never be taken advantage of like that again. And in so doing, I recognized that in the research I had done at the United Church of Christ, that there were thousands of communities across the U.S. that were similarly impacted to as was the place that I lived, and that maybe I shouldn't just focus my energies on what was happening where I live, but what was happening with similarly impacted communities across the country. So I went to work at the Natural Resources Defense Council and to deploy the resources of the Natural Resources Defense Council in service of communities that were fighting major environmental battles and environmental threats. And I went to work at the Ford Foundation and developed the first ever environmental justice grant-making program at the Ford Foundation to resource grassroots organizations. And now I spend my time working, literally working with those communities that are fighting particularly hazardous waste sites to really build their organizational capacity so that they can really help drive the outcome of what happens at those sites. And this is about cleaning up the legacy of hazardous waste in the U.S., but cleaning it up to such an extent that you can reuse those sites and you can do other things with them. And so that's what I spend a lot of my time doing, and not necessarily focused on reproductive rights, but because I actually come from a reproductive rights organizing background, I tend to think that it is part and parcel of every piece of work we do, because it's all about the life cycle, and it's all about protecting folks from things that they shouldn't have to live with, they shouldn't have to ingest, they shouldn't have to sleep with. So that's what I spend my every waking hour doing.
And if I could just add one quick thing that we do with respect to the work that we do, we provide trainings on the whole human rights mechanisms and solutions and meet communities at the levels to which they are. And so therefore they're able to challenge their state and local and federal officials to see to it that they need to protect their human right to health. And so that's how we actually intersect as well with the whole reproductive justice rights. And for those of you who are in the California area in LA, from March 7th through 9th, I'll be with Black Women for Wellness, where I'll be their speaker and doing some workshops with them on reproductive justice and environmental justice and the impacts of toxics. So we do things like that in collaborations as well.
Hi, thanks for so much. This has been very inspiring. I actually have two questions. One is related to two questions ago when we were talking about consumer choice, and you were talking about how consumer movements can be effective. I'd like to emphasize that university movements can also be effective and
leaders.
And so I'd like to point out, for example, that
I have been fighting a losing battle on these water bottles.
We are now.
They backslide.
Right.
Okay, so yes.
We are drinking from a Nestle water bottle here, which is actually tapped water that is cleaned out, and it's telling me it's a green bottle because they made the plastic cap 20% less plastic. So it has a nice green environmental symbol on it while we're drinking it. And of course, this is not your choice, but rather a university policy.
Right.
So A, it's a complaint, but not to you all.
Right.
So B, could you speak a little bit to how universities do matter and how student-led movements can matter?
My second question, if you were 20 years old right now and wanted to enter this career,
I would love
would you
to
students? Wow. Great questions.
Can I be 20 really years old questions. Again?
So, so we are doling out. You can be 20 years old
wow.
again.
So what could you do? Well, I stumbled into this work, and it has changed my life. I mean, it is, you know, you don't often get to do, and I hope that in the course of your careers and your life's work, you will actually get to sit down and do and be compensated for something that just makes you, you know, you feel like God has put you in the place where you're supposed to be. And that's how I feel about my work, that I sort of was a circuitous route. And then one day there I was as a research assistant. And all of a sudden I realized that this is what I was meant to do. Not everybody gets to have that opportunity. And especially if you just sort of, fall into it, I would say be much more proactive about, you know, sort of what it is or how it is that you want to intersect with this work and think about it, right? So do you want to do legal research? Do you want to work in the nonprofit legal advocacy arena? Do you want to work in the private sector? And I just want to say that, you know, all the good people are, you know, as I define it, right, good and evil. And, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about good and evil lately. Mm-hmm. Don't get me started. but all the folks cannot be in the nonprofit
That's
sector
right.
and work for government, right, which is sort of where we are. You got to have some other people who share your values and share your worldview who work in the private sector so that it would be maybe a little easier to come to some common consensus and understanding about sort of chemical industrial practices and processes. Why do I have to sue you for 30 years to get you to make less toxic bleach when you could have done it all along because you had a formula?
Right.
You know, why do we have to go through that? Right. However, you know, let's just be real about this. Lawyers are really, really, really important.
That's
because
right.
at the end of the day,
That's
when
right.
you can't get through the administrative process, through administrative practice, through your local government, when you can't get people to respect the rights of communities, then you have to
That's
fight
right.
for the rights of communities. And the way that you do that is you fight about the law. Now, the law is limiting. It's not all, you know, it's not all encompassing. It's not a panacea. But if communities of color and poor communities could be treated equally before environmental laws in this country, we would make such tremendous progress in changing the life outcomes for so mm-hmm. many communities. So the fight for equal justice, the fight for reproductive rights, the fight for racial justice and for civil rights is a fight that continues to go on. We tend to talk about it in the past, but it's not in the past. Mm-hmm. And as you can hear and may have heard last night, if you listened to that crazy stuff on CNN, that crazy four people were saying. But, you know, so it's intangible, right? You know, I thought when I was in high school that I would never have to talk about reproductive rights again. Right. I would never have to talk about access to contraception or to mm-hmm. abortion or my right to mm-hmm. the integrity of my body. I just thought I would never have to have that conversation mm-hmm. again from mm-hmm. 1975. And I'm mm-hmm. so sorry that whatever we did do enough so that
That's
you wouldn't
right.
have to live through it too. But
That's
here
right.
it is. Everybody step up and let's do
That's
what we
right.
have to do.
One thing I'd like to add, just one thing to add on what university students can do. So I think, you know, because universities are places where people live and breathe and, you know, they're eating food, they're drinking water, right? There's a very close personal connection. So I think there's a lot of opportunity just to think about how are you living in this space. But I would also say, you know, don't forget about all of the people who help make this space possible. So things like who's cleaning these buildings? What products are they exposed
yes.
to?
Yes.
How can students help make their jobs
right.
safer and healthier by making sure that they're even allowed to use safer products.
Right.
We know a lot of folks have no choice about the products
That's
they
right.
use. So just I would say how do we de-invisibilize all of the people who make this space possible?
All right, we're going to take one last question.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for your conference. But I think one topic is missing, and nobody has really addressed pharmaceutical companies. We've talked about contraceptives
right.
and all this. But there are chemicals in there, and, you know, they're the ones that are financing great part of the contraceptive movements and reproductive rights. So what should our stand be, you know, since they're I don't know. It's a question I I cannot even answer because they're our enemy or not or what.
Yeah, you're right. They're the enemy man. Because I tell you why. You know, when it goes back to the slide that Kimberly had with respect to the Toxic Substance Control Act, the Safer Chemicals Act, that is the reason. Because, see, part of the issue is, and one of the things that when I went back to saying my family members had died, I'm from Wilmington, Delaware, the land of DuPont. But DuPont also owns Merck Chemicals. And so oftentimes you'll have the industrialized chemical companies owning the pharmaceutical companies, and they pay high-priced lawyers, right, to do their bidding to say, okay, now we have to protect patent rights, right? And so they'll hide behind part of the issue with TSCA, with the Toxic Substance Control Act, and the reason why we have this plethora of chemicals on the market is because those very same chemical corporations who own the pharmaceutical corporations hid under the fact that we can't disclose the ingredients, so that of proprietary rights. And so that's how you had all these chemicals out the door and on the market. So you hit the nail on the head, and then they then turn around and are cozied up with the folks like Monsanto, right? Because then we go back to what my sister friend Bernice was talking about with, and this is why we have to be very mindful about these wars and all these other things, because when it gets right down to it, war is basically fought for that of resources, and mostly natural resources are owned and governed by a lot of these pharmaceutical companies, which in turn are that of the industrial companies. So you have all of this mishmash, if you will, but you're right, the forerunner is that of the pharmaceutical companies, and that's where we really need to jam this thing up. You're right.
But I just want to say, and not that I am at all in favor of, you know, pharmaceutical companies, they have created a tremendous amount of pollution mm-hmm. and a tremendous amount of harm around the country. But I just want to say, I thank God for the birth control pill. I just want to say.
Oh, yeah,
now,
me too.
Could they but, you know, employ ethics, a higher standard of medical ethics and scientific ethics in what they produce and how they inform people of what they're putting on the market? I don't know if you take time to listen to these commercials, but, you know, the commercials for the new reproductive drugs that are on the market, you know, beware that the side effect could be permanent sterilization, mm-hmm. you know, at-risk bleeding, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just trying to think, how did that get approved and get on the market? Mm-hmm. How did that get through the FDA? Right? So yet another role for lawyers, mm-hmm. right? So you could be lawyers for pharmaceutical companies. You could be lawyers at the FDA. You could be lawyers at the Reproductive Law and Justice Center. You could be in a variety of places in this arena to battle this fight. But we can't all be in the same spot,
right,
which I think has been part of our, you know, of our limitation, is that we're all, if you could get all the people who do this work, we could all fit in the ballroom of some hotel in D.C.
That's right.
And that, you know, that just, that's not effective.
Right.
All right, any concluding remarks?
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, I want to thank our panelists for
you.
An absolutely amazing I think I probably speak for the rest of the group that if we could all do half as much work as you do, we might actually be satisfied with ourselves at the end of the day. So I want to thank you both for being here and for the amazing, amazing work that you do, and thank you for sharing it with our campus community. A couple of notes for students. I want to emphasize there is a conference to which our panelists will be receiving fancy gilded invitations, but which you all can register for as well. And that is a conference on global health, gender, and human rights that's coming up March 21st and 22nd. There is specifically within that conference a working group on maternal mortality and morbidity, which will be addressing access to contraception, safe and legal abortion, and reproductive justice issues. There is also a cross-cutting theme of access to information, in particular with regards to pharmaceuticals and the health effects of various drugs, as well as a bunch of other really interesting topics. So I encourage all of our students to register for that. Once again, let me thank Angie McCarthy, Gerald, and Melissa for putting on a great event. and thank our panelists once again, and thank you all for coming.